This Edgar Profiles podcast is supported by Ping. Edgar is an association of national federations formed in the year 2000 to develop and encourage initiatives which raise the awareness of golf, both as a participation and competitive sport for individuals with disability. For more information about Edgar, please visit edgargolf.com. Your host for this episode is Tony Bennett. Ping. Play your best.
I'm Tony Bennett. Before I start, I would like to tell you a short, personal, and true story about Ping.
A key resource that has enabled Ping to perform experiments and extensive tests on new golf designs is a superhero who was once described as the world's best golfer. At only 5 feet high, 6 feet wide, and 7 foot thick, weighs over 1,000 pounds, he is known as Pingman. Pingman is a robot that is used for product and prototype testing. He mimics human movement by having a shoulder turn and a wrist hinge that can load a golf shaft on the way down. He can even bend 10 degrees at the waist like a human golfer to accommodate clubs from a wedge to a driver. Pingman hits tens of thousands of golf balls a year. He only hits brand new golf balls to ensure accurate testing and tests 9 different face locations on the product to ensure we know exactly how product will perform from not only centrally struck shots, but from off-centered struck shots too. Pingman can swing it up to 160 miles per hour, which compared to a couple of Ping's big hitters in Bubba Watson and Tony Finau, who get it out at a very respectable 125 miles per hour, Pingman is like no other golfer on the planet. Thanks to the data Pingman produces, Ping only introduces new product when testing it to be proven to be better performing than the current product.
As stones settle into the stream and alter the path of the water, life tends to throw the occasional rock, which can adjust one's life course. One Easter, my guest got the first sign that something was not quite right. Waking up feeling terribly hungover is a price we all pay for a few drinks too many. But what if you hadn't had a drink that night before? A visit to the doctors revealed a case of optic neuritis, which after further tests was considered to be a clinically isolated case. My guest, Amy Bullock, tells me about her life before and since that diagnosis, of her busy life as a 20-something, which included training to be an accountant, playing high-level hockey and working, often 50 or 60 hours per week. Amy tells me about other warning signs that were so simple, but they did not seem like warning signs at all. Continually pulling at her right sock to get it to fit comfortably, before recognizing that, in fact, she'd lost the feeling in her right heel. Eventually, Amy was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, MS as it's commonly known, is a condition which affects the brain and spinal cord, and it seems that every case is unique. Amy tells me how she manages her condition and how golf has been life-changing. To use a maxim that seems to be a common theme in her vocabulary, let's get on with it. Amy, it's just fantastic to be with you. I know you've been pretty busy recently and travelling around a little bit. Tell me, where am I finding you today?
I've been at home today, recovering as I played in a fun competition at my golf club yesterday. So that was good, but a bit tiring, a bit wet out there, so I'm a bit tired today.
What is your golf club, Amy?
I'm fortunate to be a member of two golf clubs. So I'm a member of a club called Sunningdale Heath Golf Club, which was previously known as Sunningdale Ladies.
Okay.
And I'm also a member at Woking Golf Club, where I keep my golf handicap. It's my home club.
And Sunningdale Heath, is that actually next to or in the Sunningdale golf facility?
It's next door to what we refer to as Big Sunningdale.
Right.
So just a bit of brief history. So Sunningdale Ladies was established for the wives of the gentlemen members at Sunningdale, I think in 1902, because they didn't want the ladies getting in their way.
Right.
So it's been predominantly a ladies golf club, but there is gentlemen members.
When did it change to Sunningdale Heath?
It changed to Sunningdale Heath about a year and a half ago to try and make the world see, I suppose, to the outside that it wasn't just a ladies only club, because there are gentlemen members.
Okay.
But people always thought it was just a ladies club.
Right. Sunningdale's a beautiful place, that's for sure.
Yes. So the course at Sunningdale Heath is basically a small version of the old course at Sunningdale, so it's very beautiful.
Right, and you say also at Woking Golf Club as well.
Yes, at Woking. That's a longer course, so it's got par fives, which Sunningdale Heath doesn't have, but the same, it's a beautiful Heathland course.
And you've been into sport, really, from very early age, I guess, and in fact you were quite good at as a hockey player, and I know you represented the team in the South of England First Division. Was sport a very significant part of your life as you grew up and you went through adolescence?
I think I would probably remember most of my childhood from playing sport of some sort. I don't remember much else about school, to be honest.
And
so, yeah, I played everything. I had a go at any sport and participated in everything possible, really.
Is that because the family was into sport, or were you the first one?
The family wasn't really into sport. My two cousins were a little bit older than my brother and I, and they were both very much into sport. So we used to spend a lot of summer holidays together. So we'd always be playing football and cricket and things like that, really, together.
Right. So you obviously had to juggle school with your other sporting pastimes. And so how did you manage to balance the two?
I was quite a good student, really. I got on with my homework as soon as I got in from school so that I could cram in as much sport as possible in the back garden.
Right. Okay. And what did you want to do when you left school?
That's quite a good question, really. I suppose when I left school, I had great ambitions that I wanted to do something amazing sport-wise, and I stumbled into being an accountant.
Right. Well, that was slightly different.
Quite different, yes. I think if I could have played hockey for England, I'd have been really happy. But I ended up being an accountant, but equally as happy.
Well, you share that with Padraig Harrington, who qualified as an accountant and then obviously went on for a stellar career in golf.
Yes. Not quite as good as him, though, unfortunately.
Tell me, who introduced you to golf, and did you take it seriously when you first got started, or was it just a gradual thing?
It was more of a gradual thing. I had lessons when I was about 14 or 15 at school, and I absolutely hated it. And I think I'm a right-handed individual, and I think I was probably given a right-handed golf club. And as it transpires, I'm quite good at golf left-handed. And so I found it really quite a challenge when I had a few lessons at school and hated it. And so I didn't really participate at all. And then just by chance, I stumbled across a set of left-handed golf clubs and was invited after a hockey training session to join some others to play golf. So I thought it might be a bit of a laugh. And so I had a go.
Right.
I started playing a bit more just in the summer when I wasn't playing hockey in the winter. So I was a bit of a fair weather golfer. If it rained, I was definitely not right. Playing and sort of just went to the driving range quite a bit and sort of took it from there, really.
Tell me about hockey, because I don't really understand the game very well. But am I right in thinking that you can only play hockey right-handed?
You can. There are only right-handed hockey sticks. If you had left and right-handed, I think it would turn into an even more dangerous sport than it currently is. But yes, you can only have right-handed sticks, yep. Rather, and even if you give me a right-handed golf club, I can't even work out how to swing it like a hockey stick. My brain just goes into meltdown.
Really?
Yeah, I just have no idea what to do.
And so tell me about your golf swing then. Is your golf swing quite short, rather like a hockey swing?
It started out, everybody said I looked like a hockey player playing golf, which I was amazed at, because I thought, I'm playing a sport left-handed that I would play right-handed. How could I possibly look like that? But I had very little backswing. but somebody complimented me quite recently about how my game has developed, how my golf has developed since I joined Woking Golf Club. And so I get to sort of hit a longer ball, and my golf swing has increased in length.
Right. And did you have anybody who helped you with your golf? Did you have a coach or a professional, somebody who kind of took you under their wing and helped you a little bit?
I went to I had some lessons at a pay and play course, because I couldn't even hit the ball in the air when I first started. And then, to be honest, I've kind of bumbled along, really, with my golf. having the odd lesson here and there, but I started to take it much more seriously in the last few years. So I've been having lessons with the pro at Woking, Carl, which has been brilliant, really brilliant.
Right. And so what are you working on just now?
At the moment, I'm working on my stance and just to try to be a bit more balanced and working on my short game at the moment.
Okay, getting ready for the season.
Yeah. It seems my short game seems to have deserted me in the last 12 months, so I'm trying to bring it back.
So tell me what it was like. So you're a 20-something year old, and what did your average day look like when you were getting started?
In my 20s, I was training at a firm of accountants to be a qualified accountant. So I'd be working a 9 till 5:30 job. I was trying to fit in 2 to 3 hours of studying most evenings. And if I wasn't studying, then I was at hockey training, either doing sort of skills training or fitness training during the week.
So and that,
and then I was eating and sleeping.
Right, and that study was for accountancy, yes?
It was, yeah. Yes.
And then one morning you woke up feeling a bit rough, and within a week you'd lost the sight in one eye. And I mean, this obviously must have been pretty scary. So how did you react, and actually what had happened?
It was a bit of a strange day, really. I woke up one morning feeling terribly hungover, having not had anything to drink the night before and feeling quite rough. And I drove to a client's and I nearly crashed my car on the way to work because I just felt so terrible. And I had a chat with a doctor, and I thought perhaps I was suffering from a migraine, having never had a migraine before. And then it coincided, all of this, with the Easter weekend. So I had sort of a bank holiday weekend of feeling unwell and quite a lot of pain in my eye, and knew that I didn't feel quite right. And it was only when I went to my GP's on the Tuesday and she asked me to look at the eye chart that all I could read was the large letter at the top, that I realised that my sight had really almost deteriorated to nothing in one eye.
Mm. And had you had any warning or any warning signals or any strange kind of feelings in the days leading up to this?
I think I've come sort of to learn with MS and MS types attack is that for me, I tend to get quite inward in myself in the build up to having an episode. So I felt sort of quite sort of antisocial for a few weeks beforehand. And I'd also felt really quite stressed about life for no real reason. But otherwise, I wouldn't have said anything else was different in life at all in the lead up to it.
So you eventually you go to the doctors, and what did they say? What did they advise you to do?
My GP was brilliant. She spent an hour and 15 minutes with me and sent me off immediately to the eye hospital to be looked at. And then I did a field of vision test where it was quite obvious I had lost the sight in my eye, and was sent off for lots of other tests, really.
So immediately after this, did you have any inclination that this might be MS?
I knew, I had an appointment with a neurologist, and I knew from that the what I was suffering from with my eyesight was called optic neuritis, and it's a classic, or not a classic, but it is a common first sign of MS. But I'd had quite a lot of other tests, and I had no other symptoms, and my brain scans were all clear. So at that point, it was deemed a clinically isolated syndrome, and I would be monitored for the future to see if it developed into anything else.
Right, and over time, your eyesight returned. Did you feel that things would get back to normal then?
It took about a year for my eyesight to return, and to begin with, I thought that would sort of never happen. I would never be able to see. But my neurologist was very confident that's what happens. And I had a course of steroids to try and help speed up the recovery. And eventually I began to see again, which was quite amazing in a lot of ways. But at the same time, when I exercise and my body temperature rises, then my sight would deteriorate again. So every time I did some sport, my eyesight, I would lose the eyesight in my eye again, and then it would gradually come back sort of 20 minutes to half an hour afterwards.
Right. This must have all been a lot to take in. I mean, how old are you now?
I'm 45 now, and that all happened when I was 36. I had the first optic neuritis when I was 36. So I think I just got on with it, really. My mum will hate me for saying this, but when I was with her at the hospital and they said what had happened, she said, I know it's really bad news, but you're just going to have to get on with it.
Right.
And so I suppose that's what I did. I just had to get on with it.
Is that kind of a family trait? Just get on with it?
And not necessarily, but I think my mum was in a bit of shock at the time, and that was kind of her sort of pep talk for me, really. But I'm quite a determined and stubborn person, and I don't normally let things sort of get in the way of me doing stuff. And I had to work, I had to get on with life, and I didn't know how long it was going to take for my eyesight to come back. And so in a lot of ways, I just sort of had to get used to it and sort of carry on with life.
So after this first episode, and you call it an episode, you gave up hockey. And for someone who played so much, and obviously with an idea perhaps of making a career out of hockey, can you explain your feelings of giving up the sport at that time?
It was, I suppose, also at 36, I was getting a bit old for hockey, and my body was suffering quite a bit from training and playing. And so it wasn't an easy decision to make, because it was a sport I loved. But I had had an incident with my brother in the park where he threw a tennis ball at me to catch. And because I couldn't see properly, I completely misjudged the ball and it sailed over my head. And I thought, I don't really want, I've always played hockey to a high level, and I don't really want to find myself having to play at quite a low level, because I can't play at the speed of the game I want to. And I just want to finish having played at a good standard and not sort of deteriorate with my hockey. So it was not a difficult decision to make in some ways.
Right. And you got into golf a little bit more seriously then?
I did at that point. I had a friend who said, do you fancy coming and playing at Sunningdale Ladies on a Friday afternoon for a bit of a laugh? And so I turned up, and the club secretary did a pretty good job on me, because within 3 weeks I joined as a member.
Okay. Okay, so what was it the club secretary said to you that turned you on?
Well, I think it was more that I would always be looking for a sport to replace playing hockey. I was used to devoting pretty much every Saturday of the year to some sort of hockey. And so it seemed sort of, I played a bit of golf, I wasn't bad, and I thought, well, why not? I'll give it a go.
It must have been a very big difference to go from what is a very team orientated game to what essentially is an individual sport, which every now and then comes together to play in a team format. But what have you found, both the pros and the cons of the difference between the two sports?
To begin with, I really missed the whole team sport part of it. The sort of banter and the teamness that you get from hockey, and the fun that you have with that, doesn't really translate very well onto the golf course. But I suppose that when I started, I was given a handicap of 27. I didn't really take it too seriously. The ladies I played with sort of went out on a Saturday just to enjoy themselves. And so you had quite a lot of chatting and a lot of fun while you were playing. So the transition from one to the other, a team to individual, wasn't quite sort of a leap, really. Right. I sort of gradually got into it.
Right. And now you play, obviously, most of your golf at the golf clubs with the ladies, also with the guys as well?
Not too often with the guys, actually. At Woking, I play only with the ladies, really. And then I've perhaps at Sunnydale Heath, I play in the odd mixed event. Right.
But it wasn't only hockey that you played, was it? Because you were quite a keen road cyclist, I understand. And I hear that you competed in the London 100 Mile, which followed the road race route from the Olympic Games in 2012 in London. So, I mean, I'm a pretty keen cyclist, but I'm not going to do those kind of things. So tell me about the journey that you had there on that route and the highlights of that ride.
Oh, it was a fantastic thing. I was, when London had the Olympics, it was just amazing. And I loved every minute of watching it. And when they announced that they were going to do a road race that followed the route of the Olympics, I was desperate to get in. And I was fortunate enough to get a place in the ballot. And I'd already done quite a bit of cycling, but nothing at that sort of distance, really. And so I absolutely loved the training. I competed in it or entered in it with two of my friends, and we pushed ourselves really hard. But the whole day was just absolutely amazing, starting at the Olympic Park at sunrise, cycling all through London, out into the Surrey Hills, and then finish line at Buckingham Palace with my family all there cheering me on. And it was a bit of a big thing for me, because it was only sort of 5 months after I'd been diagnosed with MS, and it was a real sort of challenge to myself that I could still do these things.
And your training had obviously started before you had the diagnosis.
Yeah, I'd competed in things like the Palace to Palace bike ride, which was a 45-mile bike ride. I'd taken part in the London to Brighton night bike ride. That was a good challenge. That was during the night, set off from Clapham Common at midnight and cycled down to Brighton during the night there for sunrise. So I'd competed in a few events, but nothing sort of, not 100 miles. It was quite a challenge.
So do you have a time for that 100-mile ride?
I think our official time is 6.5 hours, but we probably stopped for over an hour of that time, was stopping and eating and refueling and things like toilet stops and things like that.
And the three of you all competed together, or did you just stay together?
My two friends that were doing with me were there to look after me,
right,
really. But we stuck together. We started together and we finished together. So it was
good. You mentioned it was 5 months, more or less, since you had the diagnosis. That was just before your 40th birthday. And
yes.
Were you expecting that diagnosis? Was that something that you knew was going to happen?
The period of diagnosis took about 3 or 4 months, really, from start to finish. In some ways, I had felt slightly unwell in the November time, and really odd thing that you'd think a bit bizarre, but I had hadn't really put two and two together really at the time. But I had spent a lot of time rearranging my socks while I was playing in my right foot while I was playing golf, to a point where I was tugging them so much that I was actually ripping my socks while I was playing golf because they were irritating me so much. And it turned out that I'd lost some of the feeling in my foot, and it was just that and the uncomfortableness of the sock that had was causing me a bit of issues. And so when I realized that I sort of my heel had gone numb, I went back in to see my neurologist and had a brain scan, which showed that I had some lesions on my brain. And so the sort of diagnosis process after that took sort of 2 or 3 months, but I had known before the official diagnosis that that's what was going to happen.
So what was the difference to actually between having the official label attached to you and the realization that you already knew that you had MS, which came before? Was there a difference between having that tag attached to you or not?
Not hugely. I think at the time when I was told, that was just before Christmas, I was told that it was going to be a diagnosis of MS. I had this sort of realization to myself that up until then it had only affected my left eye, and now it had affected my right foot. And so to me, I was just like, okay, so it's now part of me and part of my body and part of what's happening to me. And so it was at that point really that I sort of had to get used to it from then on, really. But the actual date was just to make sure in some ways that it was all done and dusted before I got to celebrate my 40th birthday.
Right. And what impact did that have on your everyday life?
It had absolutely no impact on my day-to-day life, which was a massive mistake on reflection. So I carried on working 50, 60-hour weeks, and I carried on cycling really hard, and I still played golf as much as I could. And I, at that point, tried to not let it affect my life whatsoever, which on reflection, a couple of years later, was probably a big mistake. But there was that whole sense of life has to carry on, and I don't want to let it impact on my life.
You say it was a big mistake, and I understand that tiredness is quite an issue for people with MS when I've looked at some of the research. Have you found that to be the case in your case?
Yeah, that's one of the hardest things for me to manage, really, is to cope with is the tiredness. I've always been sort of out and about, active, working hard and doing lots of things. So some days the tiredness just hits you, and that's been quite a difficult part of the sort of symptoms to deal with.
So I know that you gave up cycling due to some balance issues and also the volume of training, and that relates very closely to the energy that you require for the day and the tiredness. But have you found that golf has been a good replacement sport? Because, I mean, in golf you're going to walk 7, 8, 9 miles, depending on how badly you play or how well you play. and you're going to do that over anywhere between 4 and 5 hours, potentially, most days that you play. So is that easy to manage, or how do you manage it?
It's not easy to manage. Some days I find it easier than others. And the fact that I can be in a buggy is also a big help, really, in that kind of thing. But I try... the more I've got into playing golf, I've now realised I have to apply some of the principles that I would have applied to cycling, whereas I would be fully hydrated all the time cycling and I would eat at regular intervals to keep my energy levels up. It's taken me a while, but I've had a bit of a light bulb moment, and I think, right, well, I have to apply those principles to golf as well, and in fact to day-to-day life, so that I make sure I'm eating correctly, and when I'm playing sport, I'm well hydrated as well at the same time.
And what about on your working life? How do you manage that?
To begin with, I worked really hard, and I after I was diagnosed, and I ran my own accountancy practice, but it became too much, really. The stress was not good for my health, and the working hours were not good for my health. And I wasn't very well afterwards. And at the moment, I'm not currently working.
Right.
Due to my health.
And you've got golf now as your primary sport. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, you stumbled across Edgar by accident. Can you tell me how you found the association in the first place?
I'd been signed off work sick, and I was unwell, and I was still cycling at the time, and I was playing golf. So I just did some Google searches about sport, disabilities, golf and cycling. And I stumbled across Edgar.
And then?
And then I thought, wow, this is quite amazing. And went to see my neurologist to have a bit of a chat with him about it.
And golf, I think, if I'm not mistaken, you've said, or you're on record of saying, that golf has been life-changing for you. So can you walk me through what golf means to you and how it has had a positive impact on your life?
It's come along at a time where I'm a very competitive person. I love sport, and it's filled a gap that the hockey and the cycling that I was doing and it's given me the opportunity to be active and exercise, be competitive, and I love and enjoy sport, and it's and I love and enjoy playing golf, and I've met some amazing people.
Well, I know you're very competitive because you competed in the European Individual in 2016, finished third. Do you have any aspirations for this year's European Individual at Troyer?
There's going to be a tough ladies competition, I think, this year. There's with Meta and Daphne and Marcella, all low handicap golfers. For me, I think this year, if I could finish third again, that would be a good achievement. When I think about the rest of the field that are playing, if I could play to my handicap and do well in the net competition, then that would be brilliant as well.
Do you know the golf course at Troyer?
I have been over there and had a game of golf around there. It will be a tough challenge. Won't be easy out there at all.
What have you learned about yourself by playing golf?
I've discovered that I am as determined as I thought I was. And it's quite a mental challenge that I've never really had to deal with playing team sports all the time. So playing in an individual sport, it's been quite a mental challenge. And I've had to work hard on that part of the game.
Is there any takeaways that you might be able to share with us that you think others might be able to learn from by having played golf?
I think not to be intimidated by players that have got lower handicaps than you. The golfing system of handicaps is brilliant, so that people of all abilities can play with and against each other on quite a level playing field. So not to be intimidated and hit the ball and enjoy it is what I would say.
Any adjustments that you might make to golf to make it more user-friendly?
I think golf is beginning to change hugely in the last few years. I think golf clubs need to be more user-friendly and less stuffy, I suppose, about etiquette, what you wear and all those sorts of things. And I think there's rule changes coming up which are going to be interesting, might make it more user-friendly. Things like golf sixes is also quite good fun. Just brings it to a different audience of people.
I know you're involved a little bit now with Edgar's development committee. What are you looking to try and achieve there?
Oh, I'm quite excited about that. I was lucky to spend a day with Mark Taylor, being given some coaching on how to coach golf. And I'm really looking forward to bringing golf to a new audience in the local community, to me, people with disabilities that might not have even considered golf as an option to play, and spreading the word about what a great sport golf is.
And what about females in golf? Because clearly this has been a conversation for a number of years. There definitely is more male golfers than female golfers. Why do you think that might be?
I think that's quite a good... Oh, that's a tough question. And I think it's traditionally been a male sport. There's some barriers to golf in some ways, in terms of cost of equipment and time and those sorts of things. But I think more women are getting interested in golf. It's definitely, I believe, the bigger growing area for golf participation is with women at the moment.
Yeah, it seems to be that it's increasing. It's been pretty strong on continental Europe for quite a number of years, but it seems to be increasing a little bit now. Certainly, there's more initiatives to get more women playing the game. And I know for sure that with disability golf, there's still this very big gap between the number of female golfers and the number of male golfers. And maybe, to some degree, that's because of injuries that perhaps are more associated with male occupations, potentially.
Potentially,
But nevertheless, it seems to me there's a big opportunity to get more female golfers with disability playing the game.
I think some of it comes down to awareness, I think, as well.
How do you mean?
I'm not in terms of whether people whether women know that there are opportunities to play disabled golf or play or get into playing golf.
Yeah, I think you're right.
In the same way as it is for all women, really, about playing golf, I think. But I think it's harder for women with disabilities, but it might be just that they just don't know it exists.
I think that when we talk about that, I think that if we can get more therapists, doctors, healthcare people to understand that golf is an option, it's a viable sporting option for many people to play, that would serve us very well. And
yeah, I mean, my neurologist has been very encouraging of my participation in golf.
Yeah. Is there anything that might surprise us about Amy?
Absolutely nothing. I am. What you get is what you see is what you get, basically. I've got no hidden surprises. I'm not talented at anything extraordinary or anything like that. I am what you see is what you get.
Well, tell me about the piece of golf equipment that gives you the most joy, Amy.
I think probably my driver, to be honest. It's the club that I found the hardest to use. But I've been determined in recent years to crack it. And I think it's when I hit it, it's the club I enjoy the most.
Excellent. Now, I gave you a little bit notice on this next question, which was if you could play a four ball with anyone, dead or alive, and you don't even have to know that they play golf, who would your three playing partners be and why would you choose them?
I really struggled to... This question stressed me out a little bit.
Sorry about that.
With the notice. No, because I asked other people's opinions, or if they had to pick three people, who would they pick? So I after a lot of thought, I came up with my three individuals.
Okay.
So they are David Aldridge, who was the head teacher at the school I went to up until the age of 11. And he was extremely encouraging of my participation in sport up to a point where he, when I was age 10, so in the early 80s, he arranged that I could play in the boys' cricket team for my school.
Okay.
Which was a bit out there at that time.
Excellent.
Yep. The next person would be my neurologist, Dr. Richard Nicholas, because he's always been very encouraging. And has always said to me at my consultations, it's about keeping life as normal as possible, whatever normal is for you.
Do you happen to know if those two people that you've mentioned already or do play golf or not?
I don't think they do. I don't think they do. No.
That's interesting that you said your neurologist has been very supportive all along about your participation in golf. And yet it seems like he doesn't play.
No, he says it's great for me because I've got to get myself there. I've got to communicate with other people. I've got to pick a golf club. I've got to swing and hit the ball. It's all great stuff to be doing.
Perfect, perfect. And so, come on, tell me about the third one.
The third one is a bit out there. This person is neither dead or alive. They are a robot. They are R2-D2 from Star Wars.
Excellent.
So when I was a child, I got completely obsessed with Star Wars. And as an adult, I am still obsessed with Star Wars. But if I could have an R2-D2 robot in real, then that would be amazing.
So Star Wars and not Star Trek?
Yeah, Star Wars definitely.
Okay. And you've seen the latest?
And also,
you saw the latest?
Also, I have. I'm also, sometimes I don't take life too seriously, so that's sort of, R2-D2 is a bit of fun,
beautiful,
really.
Beautiful. Well, question for you, Amy. If you could magically be with someone who has a similar disability to you, what would you want to say to them?
Be determined and stubborn. But really, you need to listen to your body and don't be afraid to give in if you feel tired.
And is that what you would do differently? Because you mentioned earlier that you regretted just continuing on life as just as normal.
Yeah, do as I say, not as I do, I think would be an appropriate phrase there. I've learned in my 40s to be, or my mid-40s, I suppose now, to be more aware and to listen to my body.
Right. It's been really, really interesting, Amy. Thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
That's okay. It's good to talk.
If people wanted to reach you, how could they find you?
I'm on all the usual social media, on Twitter and Instagram as Amy MS Golfer, or at my email address, amy.bullock@outlook.com.
Fantastic. Well, Amy, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it. Have a good year, and I wish you all the best.
Thanks very
much. Take care. Bye.
Cheers. Bye.
This was an Edgar Player story supported by Ping, helping golfers to play their best. For more information about Edgar, please visit edgargolf.com. Stay tuned for the next Edgar podcast. Ping. Play your best.